Sorry.
Christ, he's tall, isn't he?
Our last speaker, morning session, Remedios Masios, our man from Lithuania.
Thank you for inviting me to be here and also thank you, Council, for suggesting this kind of long but nice title for my presentation. I think those of you who've seen the movie about singing revolution in Estonia or all these days has a kind of introduction to my speech. But actually, my speech will not be only about students of all these states. It has some theoretical insights about neighbors who are moving down, and also some historical reflections on how to deal with those moods. Of course, the topic as such is quite interesting between this theoretical and practical aspect, but I will try to provide some part of the maneuver between these two things. I would say that the theory scholars, of course, have contributed a lot of different topics related to this, like secession or isolationism or political competition or the essence and genesis of modern state and warfare, imperialism and similar topics, and of course, private production of defense and similar things. But of course, not always applying these principles today is very easy. It doesn't always satisfy the needs of all those people who are living in small communities. And for the means of national defense, which is here, but of course some questions are not answered. And for example, one of those questions is the question how to defend the country from the perspective of small country, because literature on the issue, you may see that all often scholars, they do live in big states and mostly in the United States. And it's not a surprise that, of course, they focus their interest of both scholarly research and then political activities also on big states. And for example, as Roberts says, during my lifetime, my ideological and political activism has focused on opposition to American force. Of course, to American force, and that's very understandable. But the question is that, of course, many people do not live in big states, but they live in small states, and they have to have something that is to them. And in case of small states, there is no privilege for people of those states to discuss about imperialism, isolationism, and similar concepts, because it is usually not small states who act as first ones. It's usually big states who start some kind of conflict or war. And it is only the reaction that is left to the small states. And those concepts are usually not discussed so much. What actually worries small states is what kind of strategy would be more suitable to defend the country. And of course, the Libertarians have answered this question partly because there is many literature that of course, free states is better and so on. But in case of, let's say, some projects for free countries or free states, I think that, or in general discussing the issue, I think that two other mistakes, but dead ends are met. One is when people try to draft the practical either constitution or approach towards the problem, actually proposing a kind of minimal state, or even not minimal state, in order to defend the country, which I think is wrong. Or other, almost that end practically is when we discuss theoretical aspects of private production of defense, but we see that our reality, political reality, and also the genesis of general public do not allow this principle to be implemented. And also some theoretical questions do remain. For example, as Dr. Schwabe says, that centralization is frequently progressive, and then colonial processes are often very progressive. But practically, it's very difficult to distinguish what kind of centralization is progressive one, and what kind of centralization is the direction of building practices. And of course, you have to answer these questions every day when you meet some kind of conflict. And of course, sometimes you raise a question that mission state is never to defend a country because state as such is a plunder, and maybe even if the state has an army, it doesn't have to defend the country in case of conflict. But in this case, I want to cite Robert again, and he said that concerning this kind of discussion, he said that the libertarian should save, in effect, the state. But, all right, you exist, but as long as you exist, at least confine your activity to the area which you are monopolized. Actually, it means that progress, again, is in favor of if the state is already existing and the army is already existing, you need to import that army in case of war. Some remarks about political bullying. Everyone has an image of a bully. Of course, I have also one. If, of course, as big libertarians, we see bullying in our state or in our government, and that's also the truth. But of course, we have some image of foreign bullying as well, or very often, but especially being from a smaller state. It's not really such a case in the United States, but it's definitely a case in Central Europe. But of course, the more interesting question is how we define a bully. Because it's not always an easy question, and I want to cite a popular definition of bullying at school. It's completely different, but this very reflects our topic. And bullying involves desire to hurt, hurtful action, a power imbalance, typically repetition, and unjust use of power, evident involvement by the aggressor, and a sense of being oppressed on the part of the victim. So these are the general description of bullying, which is also our topic as well. But when we turn to practicalities of international policy, it's very difficult, as I said, to distinguish what is bullying. I'll make some examples, some examples to illustrate that. For example, Armenia and Azerbaijan conflict concerning who is bullied. Who is not, or U.S. wars against country X, against some country. Of course, it's very difficult to define who is bullied and who is not. Or, for example, the Kurdistan question, or Iraq, Kurdistan, Turkey question. We had some reflections on this yesterday. Who is bullied? And we saw examples that everyone is bullied. Or, for example, Russia and Georgia in case of Abkhazia. What is the point of Abkhazia for foreigners, for stationers? Is it a secessionist state, or is it kind of reflection of Russian bullying in case of war? Or Israel-Palestine, or Israel-Arab world conflicts? What is that? And again, as Robert says, there are always the difficulties spotting the real aggressor in any particular war, when both sides are armed camps. When there are many provocations, secret treaties, deals, and frontier incidents, the question of contributing the actual starter or let alone who is more wrong, it becomes a matter of the careful research of future historians. It's not a simple question. And of course, I have to admit also that usually the bullies inside a country, and this is a nasty picture. This one's from Romania, that's quite typical for many countries about how their governments are expelling people and killing them, and according to rumor about, I don't know, about 170 million people were killed during the 20th century by their governments, and according to other estimations, there are 262 million people killed by their governments in the 20th century. But let me turn to another question. Is bullying always wrong? And for example, there was a case 2 years ago concerning Russia-Ukraine conflict concerning gas supply. It was treated as an eye-opener case for Western world showing how Russia uses energy tool as geopolitical tool. But I think that example is a bit wrong, because actually what happened there was a negotiation concerning price, and Russia was to charge market price because of the great energy generation. But of course, it's not beneficial to the people of Russia to use energy to like buying other neighbors. But of course, it's not it's not moving. Or let's take another example. We're sitting on the map there of what we see, and there's recent discussion, about 3 years already. It's a project for gas pipeline from Russia to Germany. And actually, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, and Poland are very much opposing the gas pipeline because they are not going through their countries. And of course, it means that all those countries will not have an instrument to press Russia in some case instance. And actually, if you look carefully to some aspects of political life, you can see this, there's some enclave, Russian enclave between Poland and Lithuania. And almost all chances comes through Lithuania. And actually, Lithuania was using it as a tool against Russia. And what is that? It's not Putin. Even small free state against big and free state, maybe a bully in some cases. So bully or bad guy is not always wrong, or not bully or good guy is not always right. Or we can say that all states are bullying around if they only have the ability to do it. And now let me go to the strategies of how to deal with bullying neighbor. And of course, there are some strategies like fighting or resisting in case of conflicts, allying or having a strong friend, obeying or buying out your freedom, collaborating with the bully, or the last one, which is quite untypical, but I would suggest being open to foreign investment, which I think is very essential. But before going into details, let me again speak about some fallacies concerning this. One is that it's usual to cheat and small is always weak. But in fact, it's not true, and of course, the history also proved this, starting with the fact that all big nations once were small nations, and the fact that during world wars, small nations do survive. And actually, as Paul Mises points out, there is usually help coming from abroad for small states because of different reasons, and small states are not prospects for small states are not necessarily so bad in contrary to what is popular belief. And in this case of singular revolution, one of successful examples of surviving for small states. Another notion which is wrong, I think, is that free means weak. Because it's usual to think that if you have a free, prosperous country, it means that it has very, very little centralized military power to resist a strong new neighbor. And if you lose that, this big country may be occupied very easily because there's no army to resist. But in fact, it is not true. In fact, in the press, you see more pictures like this when strong bully is weak, but not small state. But just to talk about the authors, even Machiavelli argues that small states are strong and sometimes even dangerous to other states. But small and free states are strong and sometimes even dangerous to other states. And he points out that the free nations are more prosperous, and that's what they are. They are more politically stable, and that's harder to defeat through treachery. There is high moral among their citizens that's making them better soldiers or defenders of the country. And equal opportunity and free competition among citizens tend to reward and thus foster efficiency in free states. And the high standard of living enjoyed by free nations tend to increase in population density, and gradually expand in the territory of their neighbors. So that's completely opposite arguments, which I think are quite reasonable ones. But of course, these are historical arguments, and you may have very different situations. And in fact, when historian Charles Studley, right, he says about when wars do occur. And he says that the essential tragic fact is simple: coercion works. Those who apply substantial force to their fellows get compliance. And from that compliance, they have the multiple advantage of money, goods, deference, access to pleasures, and the less powerful people. And actually, it works. And of course, bullying is sometimes a good strategy, the same as for actors in case of against business people. And one more interesting thing is that the same thing, historical analysis also showed that coercion and capital are intertwined in the genesis of states and wars, and or successful states and wars. It may be a coercion in the first place, which is like capital, and then get stronger and stronger, or it may be capital first, which actually finances some bullets in order to get some big bodies. That's sort of the fact that not matter in terms of power, it doesn't matter much because in historical we see that different conquerors are just able to those who are conquered. And for example, the excess people on the road, for example, is managing when they just feeling people to the left of France and in doing those that still like, or the it is often like all the sources of France. So in conquered, we cannot be killed, we have a total. You know, general strategies of this, and everyone are excited to work in that. But there is not pacifist policy. So therefore, also, there is not a pacifist policy. We do not hold the pacifist movement of the violence and suffering from that. We have pacifist. So this is the embarrassing group of all. But we're simply here with the second. What is the difference in the way? The movement of the day is called the agenda. The focus is in the structure of the law as its citizens and the days of the government of Israel. The process of the day on the investment actions is the same time to be this for. The whole project is not completely putting in person.
Army and how it was quite heavily financed.
But during World War II, of course, all the arms were seized by Russians and used against Lithuanians afterwards. But the next picture is the Lithuanian partisans or guerrilla pilots after World War II. And of course, guns are completely different than those that were financed with taxpayers' money before World War II. These were guns that were kept on as a militia groups or seized from enemy. But these were completely different guns. It didn't help at all. But thinking about the relative success of Lithuania, first of all, let's start this diversification process, which was also here in the Ruben, you saw the book of history. In Lithuania, we have about 10% of people immigrated from Soviet Union. In Estonia, at the moment, we have about 35%, and in Latvia, we have about 45%. So the difference is quite huge. And Lithuania had even substantial situation concerning this, because almost one third of Lithuania's territory was depopulated after World War II, because Lithuania got that illness from another big power, Poland, after World War II, and then about 300 Jews were killed, and then many Poles left this territory. And we got Lepido, our neighbor region, which again, the Lithuanians and Germans actually left the country. And these were depopulated areas. So it looked like a bit of a community for newcomers just to come and settle, etc. But actually, there were two strategies which worked in this case. First one was very intensive guerrilla work, which was even more intensive in Lithuania than in Latvia and Estonia. And there was, again, some accidents which created an atmosphere or an image that is very unsafe for Soviets, for normal Soviet men to go to Lithuania, because there's a split that would be killed. But that's it. So in small cities and villages, there were no possibility for newcomers to come because of the resistance. And resistance, you speak about numbers of the resistance, in 1 year, like 45, there were about from 30,000 to 100,000 of Lithuanian fighters in the forest and forest brothers. And actually, it was reported that, you know, sometimes the chiefs of the units actually sent soldiers home as a reserve because, you know, there was no fighters. So it means that actually all nation was fighting against Russian invasion, especially right after the World War II. And then another strategy concerning this invasion is completely different. It was cooperation of Lithuanians with Russians, because the participation of Lithuanians in the Lithuanian Communist Party was much, much higher than the participation of Latvians or Estonians in their communist parties. And it meant that they had stronger power and they had the ability to manipulate or play double games. And in the case of industrialization, it was able to send Lithuanian peasants to those new industry zones, but not to invite newcomers from other countries. So this is quite a brilliant achievement if you compare. And this offers again some of these two tactics how to deal in such a difficult situation. Of course, there is a possibility to have a strong friend in the life. And that's, I think, is very important. And for example, in the case of Kuwait, it works very well, because Kuwaitians were free riders, and then U.S. soldiers fought for the independence, and that was great for Kuwait people. It was not maybe so great for U.S. taxpayers, but it was great for Kuwait people. So why not to free ride and have this strong ally? And it was allying with your neighbors, or small free neighbors, also very important. And for example, in case of Lithuania, it's well established fact that Russian secret services were paying Lithuanian national ruling party before World War II in order to keep the conflicts between Lithuania and Poland alive, because they didn't want Poland, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia to make an alliance against possible threats from Russia, and were successful. And in fact, if we had this kind of alliance, maybe the outcome of history would be quite different. Of course, obeying the bully is again quite a tactic. And yesterday also we had an example of Kurds who are kind of deciding who will defend them. And in fact, this was quite a normal example in ancient times. And for example, well, there's no recorded actions of Palermo citizens who actually were choosing defenders very often and switched them quite often. And sometimes there's a joke that some citizens are never conquered, because citizens of all those cities were not holding the gate and handed the key of the city to the occupiers. And sometimes it is a viable solution. If there is not a split win, of course you have some problems to deal with this problem. And during the wartime, it was usual also during the Middle Ages, it's somehow also managed to the actions of aggressors in conquered territories depended very much on how victim acted before. It means if they surrendered before in siege of a city, for example, so everything was left as it was. If they surrendered after the siege, so the citizens were left to go out of the city with what they can carry on. That was it. And if they were fighting until the end, all of them were killed. So that was the usual tactics. So of course you have to calculate the end. Of course, it creates huge incentive to go around if you know that everyone is calculating. But anyway, this is quite an option. And tolerating the bully or exploiting the bully also, because in the case of Ukraine and Russia, in case of this gas, the conflict, receiving cheaper gas, of course, it's quite a good deal. You know, you sell something, but you also get something. Rules are usually quite stupid ones, you know, exploiting your own people and then sending some subsidies to abroad in order to buy out, you know, like friendships from those countries. One more thing I want to stress is openness to investment. In Austrian economics, there is usual to speak about how investment fosters economic growth, and that's completely right. But in the case of some investment from a booming country, the question seems to be more complicated. It's like in the UK or the countries before, like investment from such companies as Gazprom, it is usually treated as it is, you know, why would you have to accept this investment from this country because they would make an influence on us? And that looks quite reasonable argumentation, but in fact, it is completely true. Because if you look at the practical background of economics of this, you may see that, you know, usually small free countries is better place to make and show profits and use larger money in case of managers of state-run huge companies. And in fact, managers of the companies, they often actually do so. It's very beneficial for them to invest abroad and show profits and to take profits away somehow. Then, of course, abundance of investment in different countries creates mechanisms of checks and balances, including from different investment, different world pools. And then, if a small free country has investment from bullying neighbor, of course, bullying neighbor has less incentives to attack a country or to use economic blockade against the country because, first of all, what harms its investments. For example, in energy is the first example. If you let all the energy companies be bought out by, let's say, Russian companies, in this case, Russia would not be interested in economic blockade and not selling energy to this country. So this completely contrary to what is usually believed. And one more thing is what not to be done in case of small country. And what not to be done is, of course, what not to into the markets, into the actions of people, because first of all, it reduces possibilities to fight private, because usually arms are seized and possibilities to adapt to ever changing situation is diminished. And actually, the costs of conflict are externalized, and in the absence of internalization, there is no need for every citizen to think about how to adapt the situation and how to deal in this case when you have a living neighbor nearby. And one more thing, very important one is that is a demonstration against NATO in Ukraine. And what they say is natural gas is what we pay for NATO. And actually, this is right, but you can, this is a trade off. This is wrong soldier in Estonia, which was moved away from the place and then the riots and everything. Some people call it a soldier liberated, some people call it a monument to unknown greatness. Which you can call it both kind of a joke. But let me elaborate a little bit about state, the critics of state. If all places, all territories in Estonia would be private ones, and all effort would be private ones. So, of course, this monument would be in place of some kind of owner. And, of course, it would be for owners to decide whether to have this monument in this place or not to have. But in this case, it was not the private for common pledge. And it meant that moving out this monument was a political decision. And of course, you know, for bullying, always more easy to bully around if you have someone similar across the border, if you have some other political power. And of course, if you do not have someone to bully in order, you simply are not able to do it. So in many instances, I'm very convinced that there's always privatization, a very good tool in order to avoid bullying. And especially in the case of this new fashionable gas or electricity or oil works or energy as geopolitical tool. In case of private energy companies, you know, there's no politicians involved in the process. And there's no possibility of pressing on energy issues in order to get something politically. Because no, it's a private. Or in case, for example, in the same precipitation in both states, usually less Russian people less Russian students are willing to attend Russian schools now. And there are decisions to close Russian schools. But of course, as schools are run by government, of course it's a political decision. And as these political decisions, all Nashi or other so-called Russian patriots are able to say that, you know, those politicians, they're closing our Russian schools abroad. So they're bullying Iran. But if we imagine a situation where all schools are private, we have rules in this sector, so it means that, you know, the Russian government would have nobody to pay. That would be a completely different situation. And one more argument, what not to do, or good lessons, historical lessons. Some observers, they pay attention to the fact that in case when you have local dictator or authoritarian regime in a country, it means that dictator tries everything to persuade people just to obey the government. And actually, for ordinary people, it's not a big deal whether you obey one government or another government. While in case of free nation, it is in the essence, in the blood of people that, you know, I'm free from my own government, and it means that I will try to keep my freedom in case of possible aggression from abroad. So this kind of centralization in order to protect country, actually, in most cases, works against the goal that had been employed. And just look at the conclusion. I would say that very often strategies to stand against strong bullying neighbor been creating strong military power inside the country is simply wrong. You have to have decentralized solutions in order to be successive in long run and sometimes in short run. And the other aspect is that the only exception when military or centralized finance military deployed is when this military was already created. But it's not a strategy, it's simply like use of the track of the existing power. So that's my reflections on foreign policy. So it's more sense that thank you. This is Turkey.